Thank you for listening to Ask an Attorney with Joe Pippin. Joe has been answering legal questions on the radio in the Tampa Bay area for over 30 years. But every year during Easter, Joe does his special broadcast, The Trial of Jesus. What you are about to hear is the original Trial of Jesus program with Joe Pippin and the late Judge Harry Fogle.
We're going to be talking about the trial of Jesus, and before we really get into the subject, I've asked the judge if he'd like to make a statement before we get into the subject. Judge?
Joe, I think that many people think of dramatic courtroom trials in terms of perhaps the Baby M trial of recent vintage, or go back through history with the trial of Socrates or Charles I, Aaron Burr, and come up through these big courtroom dramas of Bruno Richard Houghton. Some may even think in terms of Perry Mason, but really one of the most dramatic trials in all of judicial history was the trial of Jesus of Nazareth some 2,000 years ago. And there's so much mysticism surrounding the crucifixion and the resurrection that we lose sight of the fact that this was a man tried under the laws of man that existed at that time.
We're going to explore that trial and get into it a little bit, and hopefully you'll learn something about the trial of Jesus Christ. Now, you have written about this subject. Can you tell us briefly where you got the information about the things you've written about this trial?
Well, I think I was first piqued by a professor at Duke who explained some of the legal aspects of the trial, and I got into it through the Bible and then in the law library at Duke University when I was a law student there. And I continued that study and have continued through the present time with references to many works and to many authorities, including at one time the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Israel. I had a discussion with him concerning the ancient rabbinic law that governed many of the aspects of the trial.
If someone wanted to do their own reading about this subject, could you kind of point them in the right direction of where to look about the trial?
There have been several. Well, I'd point them to the Holy Bible first.
Okay.
And then
a good starting point.
Yes, sir. And then there is a good, I forget the name of the book. It may well be The Trial of Jesus by West Publishing Company, a prolific publisher of legal encyclopedia and other law books that represents one of the better works, I think, in the area.
Okay, well, let's go back to the year 33 A.D. and look at the court system. Could you kind of briefly describe the court system and maybe compare it to the court system today for us?
Well, we didn't have the jury system as we know it today, but the Jewish Supreme Court and the court which tried Jesus was the Great Sanhedrin. This was the Jewish Supreme Court. The origin of the court is ascribed to Moses, and it was made up of perhaps the most influential or at least the most highly regarded people of the community of that time, the priests, the elders, and the scribes that made up the court numbered 69. There were actually 70 members, counting the high priest or presiding judge of the court.
Okay. In the article you've written here, you talk about the 23 elders, the 23 scribes, the 23 chief priests, and the 70 members made up of the high priest.
Mm-hmm.
Is this like different levels of court, or is this all one group?
This was all one group, and it was to this court, incidentally, that Jesus referred when he said to his disciples that, quote, he must go into Jerusalem and suffer many things of the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed.
Okay, so this is the exact group that he was talking about when he said those words.
Yes, sir.
What part of the phase of the trial is recorded in history? I know back then they don't have the case studies like we do today of every case that comes along, but is there something more in writing than what's in the Bible about the actual trial proceeding itself?
Only the Gospels give us any hint of what occurred that day. The writings of Josephus referred to a man called Jesus being crucified in Jerusalem on that date, but that's as far as it goes. And we have to look at the writings contained in the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, to discover what really occurred, plus comparing it with the ancient, what we know of the ancient rabbinic and Mosaic laws, the Torah, the Mishnah, the Talmud, all of these writings of the Jewish people. It was such a great, great system of law.
Would it be customary back in those days to record trials of any type of information about the trials of other people in that same time period?
Not the trials of a person, Joe, but the laws themselves under which all trials must be conducted were recorded.
So if one were to go back in history, a judge would know what happened in the case the year before because there would be some recording of it?
Not of the case itself, but only of the law which was applicable. The law was a great system of law and brought to us many of the constitutional guarantees that we know today, surprisingly enough.
All right, we're going to be talking about some of those things. Can you tell us what Jesus was actually accused of at this trial?
Well, the record is really silent as to any formal reading of a charge. Their law required the formal reading of a charge, just in what we would call the arraignment of a criminal defendant today. But there's nothing said about the charge. But the charge actually was blasphemy. The first charge on which he was tried before the Sanhedrin was a charge of blasphemy.
So the soldiers went to arrest him, right?
In the Garden of Gethsemane.
What happened at that time? Was there anything done improper when he was arrested?
Several things. First of all, the arrest was at nighttime, which was in violation of the rabbinic law that said an arrest for a capital crime must be made in the daytime. The soldiers were acting, or the Sanhedrin guards were acting on the word of an informer or
okay,
a conspirator.
Okay, let's stop there. He was arrested at nighttime. Would that be enough normally to have the case kicked out of court?
So should have been. Should have been, because okay. That was an illegal arrest.
All right.
And they were acting on the word of a conspirator, Judas Iscariot. And again, you couldn't, under their law, rely on the word of a conspirator to justify an arrest. You had to have extrinsic evidence of guilt of the offense. And so that was, again, a violation of the law. And the third violation of the law was that no judicial officer had reviewed the charge and issued a warrant, to use present-day terminology. There was no legal mandate for the arrest.
So all of those things just by themselves would have been enough to have the case kicked out of court, so to speak.
Certainly would have.
Back in those days, when you arrested someone, did you have to read them their rights?
No, they didn't have the reading of the rights, but the law itself and the court protected the accused. Now, today, of course, there is no reason, or there is a reason, but there's no duty upon our courts today to protect and defend an accused person. But the court itself had that duty to protect and defend the accused, so knowledge of these improprieties should have caused the court itself to dismiss the charges.
Okay, so the trial must have been in daytime, in the public. All these things are, and they must have had a warrant. None of these things were done. Why do you think the judges back in those times just ignored all of these things?
Well, of course, the end result had to be. There was no escaping that fact. But it's thought that the priestly side of the Sanhedrin brought about this illegal arrest and subsequent trial because it was to the priests that Jesus represented the greatest threat. If what this man was preaching and teaching throughout the countryside became accepted by the people, then the priests were being hurt in their political power and in their pocketbooks. You remember, it was just on this day, Palm Sunday, that just a few days before the trial, that Jesus had run the money changers out of the temples, and those money changers were working for the priest. He was a threat to them. They had to get rid of him. He was a victim of free speech, if you will.
All right. When Jesus went to the trial, could anything that he said himself be used against him?
No. This great system of law provided that no confession could be, that no, excuse me, no accused could be compelled to testify against himself, and no conviction could be based on the confession of an accused. Now, the right against self-incrimination is brought to us in the form of our Fifth Amendment to the Constitution, and we require today that before a confession can be admitted, it must be shown to be freely, voluntarily, and intelligently given. This is the reason for the so-called Miranda warning to an accused, where he is advised that anything he says can and will be used against him. But even a freely given, voluntarily given, intelligently given confession was not admissible under the Jewish law. That law would not admit any confession. It took the position that the state could never be permitted to rely upon that which an individual would say from his own mouth in order to secure his conviction.
All right, you're listening to Ask an Attorney all about Florida law. We're looking at the trial of Jesus Christ this morning with a very special guest, Judge Harry Fogel, who has done extensive research on this subject. Okay, let's get back to the trial of Jesus Christ. Judge, was he required to testify against himself, and did he do so at this trial?
The Jewish law had had a provision that we have today. No accused can be compelled to give testimony which may tend to incriminate him, the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution of the United States, and that was in full force and effect under the Jewish law. But not only was Jesus compelled to testify against himself, but he did testify against himself.
Were there any witnesses that came forward and testified against him at this trial.
The original, Matthew first tells us that the court sought witnesses against Jesus, but found none. But then he goes on to say, at the last came two false witnesses. Notice that Matthew refers to them as false witnesses. And the amazing thing is that, according to St. Mark, the witnesses did not agree together. This is important because the Jewish law required, in the case of a capital offense, that there be two witnesses, at least two witnesses, and if there were only two, these two had to agree in every material particular. And the discrepancy in the testimony is pointed out by the fact that one witness took the witness stand on this charge of blasphemy against Jesus, and his testimony was that what Jesus had said was, "I am able to destroy the temple." The second witness testified that what Jesus had said was, "I will destroy this temple." Now, there were only two witnesses. They were not in accord as to what had been said. And accordingly, Jesus was entitled to an acquittal at this point without being questioned as to any defense, and certainly without being compelled to testify against himself.
Let me ask you this. Were there any judges or elders or scribes or chief priests or anybody who made up this court? Was there anyone who, using today's words, removed themselves from hearing this case? Did anyone not want to be involved in this case and just remove themselves from the court?
Well, it's been suggested by some writers that Joseph of Arimathea was a member of the Sanhedrin, and there was no question that he was a member of that body, and that one version says that he removed himself as from consideration of the case because he was interested in the outcome of the case. And remember, there was no jury. The Sanhedrin was both judge and jury. And others, and perhaps a little more romantic version, is that he sat on the court. That is, Joseph of Arimathea sat in the case, but then entered a vote of guilty in order to ensure a unanimous verdict of guilt. And the reason for that is interesting. A unanimous verdict of guilt from the Sanhedrin resulted in the acquittal of the defendant.
Are you saying so if they all voted him guilty, then he would be not guilty?
Yes, and that came from the requirement of the rabbinic law that the court protect and defend the accused person. The law held that if everyone voted guilty, no one had operated in behalf of the defendant. No one had, the court had failed to protect and defend the accused as the law required.
We've heard so far that we have a very interesting case here. It seems to be one-sided to some degree. He was arrested without any warrant, so to speak. He was, their witnesses didn't agree. There was a unanimous verdict, which would result in a not guilty verdict. So it seems like it's one-sided, and we're going to get here in a few minutes to the end as to what happened and why. But first, let's go to Clearwater. Do you have a question for us?
Good morning, Joe.
Good morning.
This sounds like it was the first show trial, actually. My question, Judge, is, was this a special... I had the impression this was a special court that was convened just for this particular trial. I probably am wrong, and you can correct me on this, but the question is, was this court a sitting court as we know it today? And we also heard that there were two robbers that were also convicted along with Christ at the same time. Were these, their cases also heard at this particular time and with this particular court? And was this the only capital, was crucifixion, I assume, was the capital punishment? Were there, what other punishments were meted out by this court?
Well, this court was hearing this case. The Sanhedrin was a regularly sitting court. It's thought that it was perhaps the priestly side of the court that made up the majority of the court and really brought the court into session for this particular trial.
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, this is thought to be so because of the threat that Jesus was to the priests.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you had another question there, the latter part, and would you repeat that, please?
Yes, there were, according to the Bible, there were two robbers that were also convicted at the same time on either side of Christ on the cross, on the crucifixions. And were they also tried at that particular time in that same court, or was this from an earlier court decision, or just how did that come about?
These two were there from an earlier court decision, and let me emphasize too at this point that crucifixion was not a Jewish form of imposing the death penalty. Crucifixion is Roman and Greek in origin. The Jewish people imposed the death penalty by stoning, beheading, or strangulation. It depended upon the crime of which the accused had been convicted, and the crime crime of blasphemy for which Jesus was accused, called for death by stoning. But the Jewish people could not inflict the death penalty at this time. That could only be inflicted by the Roman authority.
And this court was of a Roman authority?
No, this court was of Jewish authority.
Well, but how did they change horses in the middle of streaming?
Well, they had to make the accusation before the imperial procurator or the imperial governor, the military governor of Rome, if you will, of Judea, if you will.
Yeah.
And that was Pontius Pilate, and that's the reason that they took Jesus before Pontius Pilate. That was the sole reason for taking him there. They didn't change horses in midstream. Pontius Pilate acted as a review court, if you will.
Oh, okay. Was it sort of like an appeal court?
Well, rather like an appeal court, except that they had to go through the trial from the very beginning. It was almost a trial de novo before Pilate, a new trial, so to speak, a separate trial before Pilate, who had to satisfy himself that all the requirements of the Jewish law had been met and followed.
Right. Thank you very much.
Yes,
all
sir.
Right. Let's kind of review what we said. Before we go into the final result of the trial here, can you kind of review all the things that were done wrong in the eyes of the court from the arrest right on up to the final verdict? Just quick summary of the things that were done wrong in court, and it should have been an instant not guilty.
Well, the arrest was illegal. The subsequent trial had these irregularities and illegalities. First of all, there were two witnesses called to testify, and the two witnesses did not agree on what Jesus had said, what they based their charge of blasphemy against Jesus upon. The witnesses not being in agreement, and the law requiring them to be in agreement, that should have resulted in an acquittal. Then the high priest, in effect, tossed aside his role as a judge. In that, he screamed, jumped to his feet, and said to Jesus, "Tell us what's wrong." His words were, "Answerest thou nothing? What is it which these accuse you of?" Jesus at first made no response, and the high priest again demanded that Jesus speak. And remember, under the law, no person could be compelled to testify against himself. "I adjure thee by the living God," Caiaphas told him, "that thou tell us whether thou be this Christ, the Son of God." And Jesus first replied, "If I tell you, you will not believe." But then Caiaphas kept on insisting, and finally he confessed, "Thou hast said it." And with that, the court simply said, "He has spoken blasphemy. We don't need any witnesses." Finally, at the latter part, that they based that on Jesus' confession, of course, and a confession was not admissible under their law. And finally, the vote itself, according to St. Mark, was a unanimous verdict of guilty. And such a verdict could not stand up under the rabbinic law.
So let's hear the final verdict of the court.
Final court, again, according to St. Mark, was they all condemned him to be guilty of death. And then they took him to Pilate. Actually,
Did they have to do that? Did they have to take him to Pilate?
Yes, they did. Okay. Pilate was the military governor, to use present-day terminology, of the Roman, Judea area under the Roman army of occupation.
Okay. Then did they have to present all the evidence back to Pilate, who would make a final decision?
Pilate was supposed to review the case from the very beginning and go all the way through it. And matter of fact, Pilate's first question to the priests that brought Jesus before him was, "What charge bring ye against this man?" Now, those words are important. They show that Pilate intended to take the case up from the very beginning with the charge. He did not say, "What have you convicted this man of?" He said, "What charge do you bring against this man?"
What he would normally ask is, "What has he been convicted of?"
Well, that's what you would think. If he was just merely going to say, "Well, it's all right to put him to death because he's been found guilty of a capital crime."
Right.
But the law required that Pilate review the work. And Pilate's an outstanding example of why it is that judges should decide cases based on the law and not based on what the people want.
So he reviewed the whole case.
And at the end of it said, "I find in him no fault." This is an acquittal. And this was the first acquittal. St. John, that comes from the book of John. And he says, "I find in him no fault," despite this. And
okay,
well,
now at that point, he should have been set free. Is that correct?
Yes, but you see, now incidentally, that charge was treason because
okay, they brought a second charge against him?
Not really a second charge. They brought a substitute charge, I think is a better word, The priests realized when Pilate said, the first thing they said to Pilate was, "If he were not a malefactor, we would not have delivered him up unto thee." Well, now you dig into those words a little bit, and what they told Pilate was, when he asked, "What charge have you got against this man?" They answered, "If he wasn't guilty, he wouldn't be here." That's something like a police officer bringing a man before me. I say, "What's the charge, officer?" And he says, "What's the difference, judge? If he wasn't guilty, he wouldn't be here."
Right. Now, when they brought up the second subcharge of treason, should that have gone back to the original court and another whole hearing taken place?
Well, not really, because either one could be construed in that manner as him usurping the authority of the priests who were ruling the country at that time unto himself, too. And this is really treason against Caesar that they're talking about. Now, they said he...
Okay, now how does Caesar fit into this whole
question? Well, Caesar was the Roman emperor. Caesar was...
So Pilate reported to Caesar?
Pilate reported to Caesar, and everyone that was under the Roman occupation had to pay obeisance to Caesar. They had to kneel and bow to Caesar, and they accused Jesus at this point of treason against Caesar. And Pilate found, said, I find in him no fault. After he had examined Jesus, he said he's innocent of treason. And this, of course, the priest couldn't stand for that. We got to understand that I don't subscribe to any theory of deicide on the part of the Jewish people, but I do believe that these priests, it was a conspiracy among the priests themselves to get rid of this man. They had to get rid of him. And they let out a roar of indignation at Pilate's verdict of innocence, and they told him, he stirreth up the people, teaching throughout all Judea, beginning from Galilee to this place. Now, this is a charge of sedition, still, again, similar to treason, called for the death penalty. But Pilate tried to get off the hook now, with this reference to Galilee. He sent them, this is where he sent them to Herod, because Herod was the tetrarch of Galilee. He was present in Jerusalem at this time for the Feast of the Passover, and he sent the priests with Jesus to Herod's palace and renewed the charges of treason and sedition before Herod. And there was another little kind of a sub-trial there, if you will, but Herod didn't get any answers from Jesus. He asked a few questions, and there were no witnesses called. It was Herod who had Jesus arrayed in the gorgeous white robe in mockery of his kingly powers, but he sent him back to Pilate without rendering any decision at all.
Okay, was there a third trial?
Well, yes, because Pilate went out to the crowd, and...
Well, this is when they changed his white robe to the purple robe.
Just after this, Pilate went out there and told him, you brought this fellow unto me as someone that perverteth the law, and I've examined him and found no fault in him. Then Pilate did an unusual thing. He said, I will therefore chastise him and release him. Now, as a lawyer, as a judge, what is he chastising?
For what, right?
Yeah, he's chastising an innocent person, according to his own statement. But he had Jesus chastised. This must have been done in an effort to assuage the bloodlust of the priests, hopeful that this would cause them to cease their demands for the crucifixion. As a matter of fact, the gospel says that Pilate sought to release him after that. But the priests then who stripped Jesus of the white robe, put him in the war cloak of purple, gave him a reed for a scepter, and crowned him with a wreath of thorns.
So we've heard everything the court has done wrong, and we've heard that he went before the court three times, and each time he was judged not guilty. Before we get to the end, let's go to Gulfport.
I'm a little confused.
All right.
The judge said that there were no records being kept.
All right, speak up just a little bit, if you will.
I am confused because the judge said there were no accurate records being kept of these trials at the time. And when did the Romans not stop persecuting Christians for not thinking like Romans? And isn't this sort of passing the buck onto the Jews who have been persecuted through centuries because of this? For what happened there?
I said earlier that the only record extant of that which occurred is from the Bible itself. Historically, the Roman government would allow local governments to exercise their own system of jurisprudence in treating criminals, and this is what the Romans did in Judea at this time.
But weren't the Romans persecuting Christians before that? Anybody that thought like Jesus?
No, there were not. There were no such things as Christians at that particular time.
I see. And it was not until after the death that they started the Christian martyrs.
Right. I don't think Christians became known as Christians until St. Paul introduced that terminology.
And wasn't the Bible written by men who might have planted these stories to suit their own purpose?
Oh, of course. You can believe what you want to believe. You don't have to believe that. That's the privilege of an American.
You see, it's just like Jews being blamed for crisis like the Negro and the white man being blamed for the plight of the Negro today.
I don't indulge in any judgment on that portion. I thought I made it clear that I don't subscribe to any theory of deicide on the part of the Jewish people.
Yeah.
I don't do that at all.
Well, I'm just unclear on that. Since it was written by men, I don't know if they didn't slant it towards not blaming the Romans because the Romans might have been directly responsible.
That's possible.
Their punishment was crucifixion, you see. If he had directly been convicted captured by the Jews, I should think that they would have stoned him to death or some other means.
Well, they couldn't do that at that time.
So
they couldn't do that at all.
Yes. Well, I just wanted to clear that up.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you. Judge Jesus was on trial for his life. Can you tell us his attitude during this whole trial and some of the things that he said to Pilate and what his reactions were as things were happening in this trial?
I think he was calm and unafraid. He had had that problem the night before in the Garden of Gethsemane as he prayed to God. But again, these things had to be his answers given to Pilate and to the priest was that he understood that he was the Son of Man and that henceforth he would sit at the right hand of God the Father.
I think he said that thou couldst have no power at all against me except if it were given from thee above.
That's what he told Pilate when Pilate asked him, whence art thou? And that was his response to Pilate.
So that kind of says what his attitude was all along. It doesn't matter what you do to me, because you only have the power to do to me what my Father is going to allow you to do.
I think that's exactly right, John.
Okay. When we get to the very end here, three times he was said not guilty. What really happened at the very end before he was put on the cross? Can you tell us? Go through that a little bit.
I think at this point, Pilate told the priests that he would give the command for the crucifixion, but at the same time, he felt that Jesus was innocent of any of the charges. He took his the basin of water before them and washed his hands in it, said, I am innocent of the blood of this just person. He had made a final effort to save Jesus, incidentally, through the opportunity given to the people to select someone who could escape the death penalty through a majority vote of the crowd. I think this to be extremely dramatic, and a great deal of the drama has been overlooked by the authors and playwrights. The name Barabbas in the Hebrew means son of Abbas, and Pilate offering them an opportunity to select someone who could escape the death penalty, asked them if they wanted to spare Jesus Barabbas or Jesus, which is called Christ. Barabbas' name means son of Abbas, and his first name was Jesus, and that was Pilate's question to the crowd at first, and they selected Jesus Barabbas to be spared and insisted that Jesus of Nazareth be executed, and it was then that Pilate finally gave the command for the execution.
So why do you think the people would vote that way? Why do you think they would vote to have...
It wasn't the people, Joe. It was the priest. It was the priest. And I emphasize again, it was the priest because they had to get rid of this guy. This guy was a threat to them.
Okay, so all the priests, the elders, the scribes, and so forth, they had the right to let one person go?
The question could be put to them. And of course, the priests were leading. They were the leaders.
They railroaded this whole thing all along. So
these were great people among the Jewish people. That is, these were the rulers. They were the leaders of the country. They were held in the highest esteem. To be selected for service on the Sanhedrin was a great honor, and reserved only for those who were of unimpeachable integrity in the eyes of the people.
Yeah.
So they looked up to them.
I was reading your article here. It says, Pilate's question to the crowd was, whom will ye that I release unto you? And so the crowd were the priests and the elders and the scribes and not the
whole people.
Okay. No. Well, we've heard the trial of Jesus Christ today, and he wound up on the cross. He was railroaded through three different trials, each one of them not guilty. Pontius Pilate, why was he concerned with what Caesar, the people were upset with him, and he was concerned about what Caesar was going to do to him if all of his people were upset?
Well, again, we're talking about the most influential people in all of Israel at this time. We're talking about the real leaders and rulers of the people, and if they went to Caesar and said, Pilate is protecting someone that we think is guilty of treason against you, Caesar was going to be pretty upset with Pilate. He was going to take that as a personal insult to him on the part of Pilate and was going to romp on Pilate pretty heavily.
So I guess Pilate just took the easy way out.
He lacked the intestinal fortitude, in nice language, to stand up against that crowd, and he took the easy way out. He didn't want to jeopardize his own lofty position there.
Does history say anything about what Caesar later thought of all this?
Caesar, it indicates, later transferred Pilate to a remote French consulate or procuratorship, and he died there, according to some reports.
Okay, was that as for what he did in this trial?
I don't think it was so much of a punishment, except it was a punishment in effect for not following with particularity the Roman law, for having indicated that he was innocent and yet acceding to the crucifixion.
Judge, would you like to make a closing statement about the trial of Jesus Christ?
Well, I think we have here just an outstanding judicial experience, and we've got to remember that Jesus Jesus was judged before he was tried. He was charged with and tried for all of these crimes, and yet was acquitted by each of the crimes. Yet he was convicted and sentenced and died. It had to be, but I think that here is an example that two of the greatest systems of jurisprudence that ever existed were prostituted to bring about the destruction of the most innocent man who ever lived.
Judge Fogel, I appreciate you being on the show today. Thank you very much for
this
hour.
Thank you, Joe.
Hi, this is Attorney Joe Pippin. Hope you enjoyed that presentation of the trial of Jesus with Attorney Joe Pippin, myself, and Judge Harry Fogel. Now I want to fill the remaining time we have with you with part of a sermon that I gave at Indian Rocks Baptist Church on the very same subject, the trial of Jesus. So I hope you enjoy this, and I hope you have a great Easter.
I'd love to do the trial of Jesus every year on the radio. It has its price, though, I must tell you. Sunday, I did the trial of Jesus on the radio, and the station was besieged with phone calls saying that I was offending Jewish people. And the program manager of our station even got a call at home saying I was offending Jewish people. And the trial was given strictly from a legal perspective. I didn't even have my Bible with me that day, and I wasn't quoting scripture. I was just telling the trial the way it was. Now, all the things they talk about and all the people they offend on talk radio, you think this would be the least likely thing that would ever offend anyone is the trial of Jesus. But the truth of the matter of fact is that some Jews may have been offended, because the story goes that the Jews and the high priest conspired against Jesus, and they were ultimately responsible for his death. Now, I did have an interesting phone call from a fellow who said that the Pope, 2 years ago, had said that the Jews were not to blame for the trial of Jesus and his crucifixion, that it was the Romans. And he was partly right, because only the Romans then could crucify anyone. But it was from the pressure of the high priest, as you'll see from the story. You have to ask yourself, how can the most innocent person that ever walked this earth be convicted, condemned, and executed, crucified? How could what are the set of circumstances, what are the set of facts that led to the crucifixion? Jesus Christ went through 6 trials, and if you count the trial before the people as a trial, he went through 7 trials. He went through 7 trials, and I'm going to go through all of the trials with you, but he went through 7 trials in a matter of 12 hours. And the end result, we all know, he was guilty. He was crucified. But what was he guilty of? Well, we're going to talk about that too. It is the most fascinating trial that I, as an attorney, love to read this trial. I love to study this trial. I usually give this talk several times around Easter time. It's the most enjoyable trial you could ever read about. It's in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, of course, in your Bible. What I'm going to do is to take the trial as it's stated in the Bible, and I'm going to add to it facts about the Jewish law, the Jewish court, and the Roman law, and we're going to interweave the trial and the law and come to an end result and tell you a few facts along the way. But if you compare the trial of Jesus against many other famous trials, there is a trial of Joan of Arc, Galileo. There was a trial of the Lindbergh kidnapping trial. There's a trial of Sirhan, Baby M. And there have been a lot of famous trials that have had some effect on certain things, but there's been no trial ever in the course of history that has had as much effect on society as the trial of Jesus. Now, I said he went through 6 trials in 12 hours, and the end result, he was crucified. You think about crucifixion as the worst death that anyone could ever imagine. It's got to be the worst penalty anyone could ever suffer. Let me read you something about crucifixion before we get into the trial. The soldiers first laid the cross in the ground and then placed him on it. They extended his feet, pulling his toes down. They drove a large nail through the arch of one foot and then through the arch of the other foot. Next, they extended his hands, allowing his knees to flex a little. They drove 2 great nails through his wrist, just below the heel of each hand. They couldn't put them through the palms of the flesh, because it would tear. Once the soldiers nailed Christ to the cross, they lifted it and dropped it in a hole. When it hit bottom, the shock caused him great pain. Now he was crucified. Slowly he began to sag more and more. With his weight being held by the nails running through his wrist, pain shot up his arms. To try to relieve the pain, the Lord pushed up on the 2 wounds in his feet. They caused even more. Hour after hour, he endured a wrenching, twisting trade-off as he tried to relieve the pain in his hands and then in his feet. And after a while, the pain made it impossible to move. At this point, the arms fatigued. Great waves of cramps swept over the muscles, knotting them in deep, throbbing pain. When these cramps come, the inability to push himself upward. Hanging by his arms, the muscles are paralyzed, and he's unable to act. Air can be drawn into the lungs, but it can't be exhaled. Jesus fights to raise himself to get 1 short breath, and eventually he dies. Now, the worst part of the story is in the Bible, where, just to make sure he was going to die fast enough, Pilate sent word to break his bones while on the cross. This is stated in the Bible. And he had been on the cross for about 5 hours when Pilate said, break his bones to speed up the death. And when the soldiers got there to break his bones, and they did break the bones of the other 2 that were being crucified, they found Jesus had already died. So then what did they do? Well, John 19, verses 32-33. 33 and 34 tell the story. The soldier stuck a spear in his side. See, when you're on the cross, the blood and water goes to the middle part of the body. And just to make sure that Jesus was dead, they knew he was, they stuck a spear in his side to let the water and the blood gush out. Now, what a horrible way to die. What did Jesus do, the most innocent person that ever walked this earth? What did he do to deserve such a punishment? And we're going to go through the story little by little so that you'll see what actually happened. Why was Jesus on trial? Whatever made them arrest him and put him on trial? Well, Jesus was a threat to the high priest. Jesus was a big threat to the high priest. He was teaching the countryside. There were huge crowds. He was preaching wisdom. He was drawing support away from the high priest, and they envied him. They couldn't stand it. He was getting the people's support. In the Bible, in Matthew chapter 26, verses 2 and 3, I'll just tell you these, and I'll tell you what they say. Mark 14, verse 1, Luke 22-2, tell you that the high priest conspired against this man named Jesus. He was teaching wisdom, roaming the countryside. He was healing people. He was feeding the 4,000 prior to that. He'd raised someone from the dead. He was going around saying that he was the Messiah. So the priest envied him, and they had to do something about this man named Jesus. Now also, just prior to the Passover, Jesus cleansed the temple. Now what does that mean? Jesus went into the temple. The temple had become more of a commercial adventure. The people had come from all over, selling their animals, selling their goods, and they were doing this inside the temple. The high priest controlled what they called the money changers. Now, what happened was that anyone who wanted to do business in the temple had to exchange their money for temple money, and the exchange rate was something else. And the high priests were making a great deal of money during the time of Passover on the exchange rate, if you will. Jesus went into the temple and chased out the money changers. He chased out the vendors. He chased out the people selling things. So again, he was doing something that angered the high priest. And between that and preaching and healing, raising the dead, and all of these things, they conspired against him. Again, Matthew 26, verses 2 and 3, Mark 14, 1, Luke 22, chapter 2, verse 2. They say that the high priest met together to conspire against Jesus to kill him. And that's exactly what happened. Let's go to the arrest. Well, let me go through this first. Let me compare the law. There are many differences in the law back then and the law today, but a lot of the law back then is the same law today. Let me explain. The Romans had the law of the 12 tables. Now, there were 120 sections of law in the 12 tables. 87 of those sections are the exact law we have today. A lot of our law came from the Roman law. So what happened, there are a lot of differences, though, I need to tell you about. One of the things was, back in those days, you had to have an airtight case, and they would not accept hearsay. They would not allow any hearsay evidence before the court at that time. They would also, now today's law, there are so many hearsay exceptions to the law that there might as well not be a law sometimes. So there's a difference between back then. They were much stricter back then on what evidence could be presented to the court. The court back then, the Jewish court, said that there could be no circumstantial evidence. You had to have hard, cold facts on someone to present at a trial. There could be no circumstantial evidence. There's rarely a case in today's law that doesn't allow circumstantial evidence. So the court then would not accept the evidence from a conspirator. They would not accept it. You had to have cold, hard facts. One person conspiring against someone could not get anywhere in the Jewish court system back then. Back then, as today, you have the right to have an attorney. In fact, you had to have someone represent you back in those days. Someone had to represent you. And if the Jewish court, which was made up of 23 scribes, 23 chief priests, 23 elders, and the high priest, 70 members, all voted against you, all 70 people voted against you, then you were acquitted because one of those 70 people had to represent you. And a unanimous verdict was an acquittal, believe it or not. That was a big difference in the law. The law would not accept self-testimony. You could not make a voluntary confession back in those days. It could not be used against you. And those are the big differences, and many of our laws are the same. Let's go to the arrest. The arrest had some reversible errors in the arrest. And if these reversible errors, if the trial had been done correctly, these reversible errors would have been presented, Jesus would have been acquitted. Number one reversible error was the arrest was at night. That was another big difference. You could not arrest anyone back in those days for a capital offense at night. Don't ask me why, but you couldn't. You could not arrest anyone at night on a capital offense. Jesus was arrested at night. It was in the dark. Judas had to go over and kiss Jesus so that the guards, the temple guards who made the arrest, would know who Jesus was. You know, it's the famous line, "Judas, thou betrayest the Son of Man with a kiss." That was a deadly kiss because that told the guards who Jesus was. Another thing illegal about the arrest was, not only was the arrest at night, which is a reversible error, but the arrest, using today's terminology, was without a warrant. You had to present evidence back in those days to the high priest or to the Supreme Court, and they had to digest it, if you will, for a day. before they would issue the warrant, the arrest warrant, to go arrest somebody. Here you have the temple guards controlled by the high priest just went out into the garden and arrested Jesus at night without any forethought, without any legal paperwork, if you will. They just did it. So the arrest was on the evidence also of a conspirator, Judas, which also was a reversible error back in those days. You couldn't take the testimony of a conspirator. You couldn't arrest anyone at night, and you had to have a warrant. Three reversible errors just on the arrest, not to mention the rest of the story. So they arrested him and took him to a high priest. They took him to the home of a high priest. And this was just a holding time. And the high priest questioned Jesus, asking him if he was the Son of God, if he was the Messiah. And at this point, let me tell you this. Jesus knew more law at the age of 12 than most of the people in the countryside. The elders were astonished, if you remember the story, that Jesus at 12 years old could speak the law. And so Jesus knew his right at this time. And at the first high priest that held him and asked him questions, Jesus said nothing. He didn't have to say anything because it couldn't have been used against him anyway, so he kept silent. Then Jesus, in the second, that was a trial before a high priest where the high priest asked him lots of questions and went over things. Then Jesus was transferred to the high priest, who then asked questions. And the high priest asked the same questions the chief priest had asked before. And Jesus was kind of silent still. He wasn't really speaking. He didn't have to, and he didn't want to. They went before the Jewish Supreme Court. Now, this was all 70 members of the Jewish Supreme Court. And they again asked him questions about being the Son of God. And Jesus admitted being the Son of God at this trial. This trial, by the way, was held at night. And there are the two problems with this. Number one, you could not, it'd be like the Supreme Court meeting secretly at night today to make a decision. The Great Sanhedrin Court could not meet at night. They had to meet during a regularly scheduled time. That was a reversible error. They also could not meet during the Passover, during a holiday. Another reversible error. There are as many as 17 reversible errors in the trial that I'm going to go through. Now, a lot of people say, a lot of the Jewish people who don't even think that Jesus was the Messiah say, well, the court system was so great. You have two of the greatest court systems there ever were at that time. The Jewish, the law from Moses, rabbinic law, and the Roman law, the law of the 12 tables, were two of the greatest judicial systems there were. And a lot of scholars might argue that they could not have made that many errors in a trial. It just wasn't done. And they were right. It wasn't usually done. This is a highly unusual case. So the Jesus admitted he was the Son of God. And they all voted, the Jewish Supreme Court, all 70 of them voted to that he was guilty. What was he guilty of? Well, he was guilty of saying he was the Messiah, the Son of God. He was guilty of saying that he could destroy a temple. Now, the Jewish Supreme Court made another error. They looked for witnesses. And as you read in the Bible, you'll find out they sought even false witnesses to testify against Jesus. And they finally found two false witnesses. But the problem was they didn't agree. They didn't have the same story. One of them said Jesus could destroy a temple and rebuild it in 3 days, and another one said that Jesus could destroy any temple. So they didn't exactly have the same story. There's something interesting about witnesses. The witnesses didn't have to take an oath back in those days. They were governed by the Ten Commandments. And if they lied, or if they were caught lying, they too were executed. That was a penalty of lying, was their own execution. So you found very few witnesses back in those days that would tell a lie. And the second part is that the witnesses that testified against people were also used in the execution process. So they took part in the execution. So they would usually have strong feelings and be exactly right and on point on the different parts of the law or what they were testifying against. So they found two false witnesses to testify against Jesus. Now the Sanhedrin Court, the Jewish Supreme Court, had no power to carry out executions at that time. That had to be done by the Roman court. So the great Sanhedrin, the Jewish Supreme Court, had to take their prisoner, Jesus, to the Roman emperor or to the Roman governor, Pontius Pilate, and present their case against him, and then Pontius Pilate would pass sentence. Well, the Jewish Supreme Court knew they were in trouble. They had a voluntary confession that could not be used. They had two false witnesses that did not agree on what they said. They had a unanimous vote. You couldn't have a unanimous vote because one of them had to represent him, and if you represented him, you couldn't vote against him. So they changed their charge. They changed the charge against Jesus to treason before Pilate. And they argued this fellow Jesus is going around preaching his Messiah. He wants to start his own nation and be king of the nation. He doesn't recognize Caesar, and all this is against Caesar. So they brought up, and not only that, he's inciting the crowd and the mob. So they brought up the new charge of treason. Jesus asked, Pontius Pilate asked Jesus about this. Was he the Messiah? And Jesus finally said, after being silent for a while, that he was. But he further convinced Pilate at this first meeting that he was not trying to set up another nation, that he was not conspiring against Caesar. And Pilate, after hearing all the testimony on this new charge, said, I can find nothing wrong with this just man, and tried to acquit him. Well, the high priest couldn't stand for this. They wanted this man dead. He was drawing away support. He was affecting their monetary, the money they were receiving. And they wanted him out of the picture. So they raised such a fuss that Pontius Pilate had a hot potato. He didn't know what to do. Herod was in town. Herod was a Roman emperor of Galilee, where Jesus was from. So Herod says, well, Pontius Pilate says, I'm going to transfer this case to Herod. And he said to himself, I'm sure, because I don't want to handle it. I don't want to make the decision. I can find no wrong with this just man. So he transferred the case to Herod. Now, Herod really didn't want the case either. He had always wanted to meet Jesus and never had the opportunity. So when he asked Jesus questions, Jesus remained silent. Jesus would not even respond to any of his questions. Herod insisted that he perform a miracle. Jesus wouldn't do it, and he wouldn't answer his questions. So Herod acquitted him and sent him back. You didn't have to testify against yourself, and the Jewish certainly weren't doing a very good job with the evidence they were coming up against this man. So at this point, you've had five trials, and basically they were a farce. And when you get to the Romans, you get to the first trial with Pilate and the first trial with Herod, they find no fault with the man and want to release him. So what happens? It goes back to Pilate. Now let me tell you about Pontius Pilate. Three times the Jewish people had complained to Caesar about Pilate. And three times, Caesar had told Pilate to change something that he was doing to appease the Jewish people. So Pilate had basically struck out with the Jewish people. He could do nothing right. The Jewish people didn't like him, and he didn't like them. Pilate was very worried about his job. He didn't want to have the Jewish leaders go back to Caesar the fourth time and said, Jesus is conspiring against you. And we brought this to Pontius Pilate, and he did nothing. So Pontius Pilate was very worried about his job. Very, very worried. So what can he do? He had the high pressure of the priests wanting him to do something. So Pilate did this. He said, I can find no fault in this man, but take him outside to the mob, have him scourged, flogged, and so forth. So here you have a judge, and a very well-known, astute judge, saying this man is innocent, but take him out to the mob and have him flogged and scourged. Now what that was a short whip with little metal things on the end of it that they gave him 40 lashes. They gave Jesus 40 lashes for nothing. They said he was innocent. And Pontius Pilate thought that would be enough to satisfy the high priest. And he thought if they did that, that would be all he'd have to do. And when that was over, the high priest kept saying, crucify him, crucify him. We've given you enough evidence. Of course, they hadn't. We've given you enough evidence to crucify him. So Pilate went to the judgment seat. They called it the judgment seat then. And he had what he thought was a hard decision. Should he have an innocent man crucified? Or was he going to lose his job? Now, while he was on the judgment seat, something interesting happened. And I, from everything I've read, think that he was leaning toward releasing Jesus. But he got a message from his wife while he was on the judgment seat. So he removed himself from the judgment seat, went to another room to take the message. And the message said, you must release this innocent man. And Pilate went back to the judgment seat, and by then the high priest had incited the mob. The high priest had incited the mob even more. And the mob outside the temple there, or the Roman court, was saying, we're all chanting now, crucify him, crucify him. So Pilate, being a very weak man of no guts, let's say, issued the order after all of that to crucify him. Just prior to that, though, Pontius Pilate was asking Jesus questions, and Pontius Pilate said, do you know I have the power to release thee or crucify thee? And that's when Jesus said, you have no power except the power given to you by God above. And that kind of stunned Pilate. And there was another famous line in there where Pontius Pilate is asking Jesus questions, and Jesus goes through saying that he was preaching the truth. And Pilate had his famous line, what is the truth? And of course, that question was never answered because Pilate went off. Pilate didn't want the blood of Jesus Christ on his hands. So he went and washed his hands before the people, saying that I wash my hands of Jesus' blood, and the blood of Jesus will be on you and not me. I can still find no fault on this man. But being the weakness that took place there, he issued the order to crucify him. No evidence against him. There were 17 errors made in the trial. The arrest was illegal. The arrest was at night. It was without a warrant. There's another interesting side story here. Jesus had a friend on the Jewish court. And that friend should have, voted against Jesus. And what the friend did, according to popular theory, let's say, is voted against Jesus. Because he knew that a unanimous verdict against Jesus would be enough to acquit Jesus, by the way the law was in that day. But you can see this whole thing was railroaded through from start to finish. Some people say there have been 20 errors in the trial. You can see all the people rising up against this person that was doing them harm. Of course, the only one that were affected really were the Jewish high priest. They were the ones with the case. They're the ones that pushed this case through, as clearly stated in the Bible. So there you have the trial of Jesus. The 17 errors were, I'll just review, and the six trials, there were the trial before a high priest, There was a trial before the chief priest. There's a trial before the Sanhedrin. There's a trial before Pilate. There's a trial before Herod. There's another trial before Pilate. There's even another trial before the people. During the Passover activities, the people, the chief priest and the people could let someone go. They could let a prisoner go. And Pontius Pilate used this as a way maybe to free Jesus. So he gave the people the vote of letting either Jesus go or Barabbas go, a noted murderer. And the people voted to let Barabbas go and to crucify Jesus. That could be the seventh trial. So the arrest was illegal. No warrant. Jesus wasn't represented by anyone. They used a voluntary confession. They trumped up a charge. Pontius Pilate reviewed all the evidence. Tried to acquit him. And all the things I've told you did not have effect on the outcome. And it should have. Any one of those things should have had an effect on the outcome.